Well, thanks for coming this afternoon. The name of this panel is Out of Control, Does Education Matter Anymore? And I'd like to introduce the panelists here. My name is Michael Anderson. To my left here is, or to my right here is Mark Milliron. To my left here is Gary Lopez. And at the end is Ellen Wagner. I thought I'd just open the panel with a couple of short introductory remarks. I work at a place called the University of Texas System Telecampus. We're the group within UT that does most of the 100% online courses and programs for the UT system. So whether or not you want to get your MBA online from UT Arlington or one of a half dozen other schools in the UT system, or get a paralegal certification from UT San Antonio, or complete your bachelor's degree in criminal justice, you usually work through us. And over the years, as we've moved a lot of the courseware and student services online and provided learning environments for students, we've kind of patted ourselves on the back and said, yeah, we're pretty cool. You know, we've taken the whole old Greek model of the academy and flipped it on its head. The Greek model of the academy as the center of education and knowledge, where all of the learners in the world had to make their trek up there to that academy and be dispensed knowledge like water from a fountain, we reversed that. We took learning and education and brought it out to people at the time and the place where they wanted it. But lately, we've been really kind of rethinking that and really kind of admitting to ourselves in some moments of truth that maybe we haven't changed anything at all. We still have courses that are semester-based length. We still have courses that are led by an instructor with 30 students. We're not really fundamentally changing education. We've enabled it. We've expanded it. We haven't fundamentally changed the way education has been delivered for 2,000 years. A lot of what we see going on in the networking area, and it's realized in a lot of the social networking tools that are starting to come out now, is fundamentally changing the way people learn. I look at my kids, and I see them getting answers to their homework out of IM windows, not out of going to the library and looking something up. I see them learning about strategy from games that they play. I see them learning about cultures from interacting in online multiplayer environments, teaching them more about critical thinking than they've ever been taught in 14 years sitting in classrooms. So that's the fundamental question that I've kind of posed to the panel here today that I'm going to ask them to talk about is, does education, formal education, classroom-based, time-constrained education really matter anymore? And what will it be like in 10 to 20 years when networks are even more pervasive than they are today? First up, I'd like to introduce a little more expanded background on him, a guy named Gary Lopez. Gary is the executive director of a group called the Monterey Institute for Technology and Education. He's been involved in a new project there that is threatening to revolutionize the whole publishing industry. He's taken the idea of social networking and applied it to the area of courseware, electronic textbooks online, electronic course materials that you can learn from online. But instead of it being built from a central place, a publisher sitting in New York who says, we know what calculus is supposed to be about and we will assemble the team that will teach you how to do calculus, he's saying maybe we should ask people who are actual practitioners out there to contribute and build collectively an intro psychology book or an intro calculus book or materials that are used in the classroom, even if it's in the online classroom. So I've asked Gary to talk about some of these ideas and how he sees content, because he's been involved in content most of his life, how content might change in a world of network delivery and reference rather than authoritative sources.
Thanks, Michael. Can you guys hear me? Yeah. I'm Gary Lopez. Welcome you all to our panel today. As Michael says, I'm a executive director of Monterey Institute, and we do a lot of different projects. One of the ones that is occupying most of our time these days is something called the National Repository of Online Courses. It's funded by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. When Michael called and asked me about speaking at this panel, one of the things he laid out was the possibility that maybe courses are actually dead, and I didn't know that, maybe courses are going to be replaced by referential websites and by empowered wikis. And it's an interesting idea and one that we kind of wrestled with our project. And I guess we came to the conclusion that while we all find, especially Wikipedia and other wikis, very useful, and I use them all the time, I wasn't sure that it was time to replace courses with wikis. And our thinking, and it wasn't to say that traditional learning, the way we do things now, as Michael referred to, isn't way behind the times, because it is. It is way behind the times. If you think about it, the way we teach and learn hasn't changed much in a long time. It's kind of set at the beginning of the industrial age, and here we are in the well into the information age, and we're still doing things pretty much the same way, not taking advantage of all the new things we know how to do. We still use a classroom and a book and a teacher, and we could do things differently. But I don't think any of you would disagree with maybe the discomfort you'd have if your surgeon or your airplane pilot or even your kid's teacher was getting all their information from Wikipedia. Make it a little uncomfortable. And it comes back to issues of authority and editorial rigor. While I think it's undeniable that wikis are very powerful tools for bringing together collective knowledge, ultimately, whether or not the authority can be counted on is left in question. And so rather than take things as they are, what we thought was maybe we ought to take advantage of some of these new tools and bring them into traditional education. It's going to get there eventually, but maybe we can help it along with our project. To take the power of what you can do in a social network, in a informational network, and apply it to the creation of content. As Michael says, rather than going back to the publishing model, maybe we do things a little bit differently. So the basic project we put together at Monterey Institute was this National Repository of Online Courses. One of the first things we did is we went around the country and we found courses that had been built by academics and academic institutions. And there were some that were individual efforts, but every once in a while we ran into courses and content were built by collective groups, where there was really an awful lot of work put in, both from a lot of different content experts, but also there's editorial rigor. There was an investment to make sure that it actually played on various technologies and it had some error handling. When we found those, we brought them into our repository, and then we invested in them too to kind of clean them up. But to go forward, to really create new content, to expand what we had, to make the repository larger, and to build new things, instead we added to this was an online community. It's a community, a network of educators, of educational institutions from around the world, all of whom participate in the development of new content, sometimes full courses, sometimes just pieces of material. And the way it works is editorial experts, content experts come in, they lend their information to the community, and what we provide are project management, engineers, designers, graphic artists, videographers, professionals in those parts of presentation and in distribution to make sure what comes out the other end actually does have curricular relevance, has editorial rigor, will play on more than one server, and then put it out for everyone to use via Creative Commons licensing. It goes out at public websites and is part of the open education resource movement that maybe you've heard about. MIT has got a part of that, as does Rice University, and we're one of the other Hewlett fundies that are putting out this high-end curricularly relevant content for public use, so everyone to use. And that's how we're sort of joining the power of social networking, the power of information networking back to traditional education, hoping to sort of move things in that direction. And ultimately, the idea here is to, first of all, take scholarship, put it back in the hands of scholars, while at the same time, basically recognizing that sort of a birthright of being a human should be that you'd have access to the very best information, the very best content. With that, I'll pass it back to Michael.
That's an interesting approach. A lot of what I see going on in higher education and in the academy is incremental movements. Slowly, we're changing things out there, and I think that perhaps we need faster change, maybe monumental change in order to affect a lot of the new things that we need to do out there. One of the people who I think is proposing some of those very fundamental changes is who's going to speak next, Ellen Wagner. Ellen is, and all three of these individuals, by the way, have doctorate degrees, all have taught And in most cases, they're all back now working in private industry or with private organizations. But Ellen is currently the executive director, senior director for education with Adobe. She was with Macromedia in the same kind of position for years. She was one of the first people that I started talking with about the idea of learning objects a long time ago. And what really impressed me recently is she came back and was at a meeting that I was at, and she had this cool, really cool phone that she had picked up when she was over in Asia. And it would do things like play learning objects on the phone. And I was like, wow, where do you get one of those phones? And she said, well, I'm sorry, you can't get them here in the U.S. yet, but they will be coming. And it was that idea of being able to deliver content in a different device at the point where you actually needed it. I mean, she had a little lesson on there that was on medical Spanish, and I thought, wow, if somebody was, you know, in a nursing office and they didn't know Spanish, but they were talking with a patient who only spoke Spanish, you could get a quick little translation here, a quick little, lesson in Spanish to be able to help this patient right at the point where it's needed. So, Ellen, do you want to talk about some of your ideas having to do with not courses, but individual learning materials, and how those might impact us in the future?
You bet. And I'm going to see if this is... Just pull that a little bit closer and assume that you can probably hear what I'm saying. Looking around, very good. It's great to be here, and it's great to be on this panel. We've had actually probably as much fun putting this thing together and talking with each other as we hope we're going to be able to share with you guys. I think one point that I guess I've seen, and I have been on the academic side for many, many years, and I was a tenured professor, so in fact I actually have walked in that world a lot, and about 10 years ago ended up leaving that environment and worked in private sector. And actually now, private sector, yes, but publicly traded company, so it's not so private. Everything we do is actually pretty public. So we have to be fairly mindful of the things that we start talking about at Adobe when we start looking at what it is that people actually do with the tools that we produce. And so that sort of accountability is really what my job is about. You've got to figure out, if we put all this technology loose in the world, what is it that practitioners really want to be able to do with it, as opposed to just like selling stacks of software. I mean, that's a very good thing in my world. But in fact, at the end of the day, it's the community that takes it forward and does stuff with it that is what transforms the work that we all do. And as we were preparing for this, there were just a couple of thoughts that came to mind. One is that I'm not certain that learning's changed all that much. I think that fundamentally human beings learn in particular ways. I do believe that what we are seeing now is that there are certain learning ways in which people have not been motivated or encouraged to learn, which are now enabled as a result of new technologies. So it's less about learning changing and more about education needing to catch up with where it is that people's learning capacity is already pretty well ramped up. So in my world, education and learning can't be the same thing. Learning is something that we do. And I will tell you, as I looked at the program here, and as I looked at the things that most of us are going to be interested in here at this event, there aren't a whole lot of sessions that would necessarily find themselves fitting into an academic curriculum yet. So I guess for all of us here, I think every one of us is living with this duality of we learn all the time, we can't stop it. We learn from each other in remarkable ways. We learn from education in other ways, but education serves a slightly different purpose for most of it, which is to make sure that we codify the development of competencies. And to Gary's point, I don't know that I want to get on an airplane with somebody who is, you know, shared some really great ideas and created new knowledge about flying that airplane. I want to make sure that there are certain competencies that are in place before I go forward. So in my world, really looking at what it's going to take to find ways of getting better synergies between the ways that people learn, the way that our education systems are allowing us to go forward, and to make sure that we understand that this is a really multivariate conversation. So, thanks, Gary. I'm sitting so excited, I'm flinging my pens every which way. My old technologies, because I still actually, as you see, paper and pencil still is a very important part of my world. I realized that really what I wanted to just do is to share just a couple of quick things. I'm probably the only one here who has a PowerPoint thing going. And I'm telling you this, I'm going to use it because I can't remember my points very easily without it. So these are my talking points that I get to share with all of you guys. So I just want to put a couple of things in. I spend a lot of my time worrying about what the future of learning is going to look like, because this is something that every single one of us in this room is going to touch, and every single one of us is going to have to be accountable to one another that we do not push something forward that makes us do the same old thing over and over and over again. But when I start looking at what this means, and we start looking at the new technologies and the new social media, there was this wonderful couple of comics I saw a while back, and I talked with Bill Ammon about using these. Foxtrot And the narration says, Jason talking to his sister, like my webpage design, she says, it's blank. He said, well, duh, this is the era of Web 2.0. Users get to generate their own content. Let's say you want to know what the latest news is. All you have to do is type it out in this box that says news, and then you can read it. Is it still raining out? I'll draw some raindrops where it says weather. And her comment, of course, is, well, so what does Web 2.1 do out? Because, of course, it's not just about creating your own content and being content with that. So the following sequence then, here's poor Jason trying to figure out how to do his web design in his 2.0 series. He comes home from school. He very, very upset, says to his mom as he hollers, what's wrong? Well, my teacher picked Eileen Jacobson's web page design over mine. All hers was a bunch of puppies and hamsters and some menus with useful information. Mine had RSS, CMS, WC3 compliance, and fully embraced the ethos of Web 2.0 and the long tail. All right. Puppies and hamsters aren't even buzzwords yet. And his mom says to him, maybe you just need to try less hard next time. And I think for all of us who are looking at this issue of transformation around learning and education, that we have to try hard, but we don't have to try so hard that it pushes us beyond what we already know. And with that, I just wanted to share a couple things that have been guiding a lot of my work lately. We've been laughingly referring to these inside the office as rules for engagement, not rules of engagement, but rules for engagement. The idea being that if you create learning experiences that actually engage people, the likelihood of their ability to want to participate in their own experiences is probably greatly enhanced. So, not surprisingly, I've got 8 simple rules I wanted to share with you guys today. And the first one is you've got to get people's attention first. Let's face it, every single one of us has so much stuff going on around us. Being able to get attention focused really is half the battle. You also have to convince the people to care. Let's face it, every single one of us is deluged with information. And most of us are simply looking for ways to filter and prioritize. So if we are putting together experiences that are going to maximize learning outcomes, why not focus on the things that the people we're talking to actually care about? We also want to motivate people to change. I mean, if you believe that learning is fundamentally a change in human capacity, that it persists over time, sometimes you just need to convince people that it matters enough for them to want to put the little bit of effort in to do it. And like most of you, I think we all find ourselves in a situation of too much stuff. What am I going to focus on? The things that matter most to me? Sometimes people just have to remind me why it matters. I think giving people choices. I think the idea, and I think the thing that I really like so much about what Gary's been doing is that rather than insisting that people continue their education by going through particular ways, extending the reach of the classroom, extending the reach of what's going on in these conversations is a really, really important part of what's going on around us. I don't know that it's the only part. In fact, I'm fairly well convinced that it's not the only part. But giving people choices to be able to have some type of control over what they do is absolutely key. Connecting people to community. You know, you can do a lot of this stuff online, but I have to tell you that the energy about rocking around this place for the next couple days is pretty much what gets a lot of us fired up to go back and slog through the things that we do. Making sure that we connect with our communities, whether face-to-face, whether virtual. Whether we're talking about the physical world or the virtual world, the fact is that is our real world right now, and connecting with our communities in all these spaces is going to be really important. I think inducing people to participate. And I wanted to give credit to my boss, a guy named Eugene Lee. Eugene is a very passionate, engaged kind of guy, and he's been jumping around our office making sure that when we look at things like engagement strategies, that it's not just about pushing stuff out, that if you don't get people to give back, then we've not done our jobs right. So making sure that you get people convinced enough to care enough to work with you, absolutely key. I think making sure people have opportunities to contribute to the digital dialogue is really important. Most of us are pretty good consumers. Most of us are pretty good producers. Focusing on being prosumers is going to be an interesting challenge, I think, for all of us. And then finally, making it an experience to remember. Let's face it. I think many of us go through experiences, learning, education, or otherwise, that don't remember what they are, but the ones that you remember, the teacher who touched you, the experience that you had that really changed the way you look at things, that's the thing that sticks with us. So those are my couple of quick points that I wanted to share.
Thanks, Ellen. One of the things that I thought was interesting about the kind of juxtaposition of these two panelists was the idea of here's a course, a self-contained course like we've done it in the past, but delivered in a lot of different ways with a lot more opportunity and freedom around it for the learner and or the instructor to choose what was the most important part of a particular discipline. That, I think, is kind of what I've called, it's the opposite of just-in-case learning. The the courses that I took in college, they taught me stuff just in case I needed to know it down the line. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, I never needed to know it. So, you know, the idea of getting the stuff at the point that I need it, you know, exactly when I need it, that is what has interested me about the whole movement around learning objects and breaking content up out of its monolithic shell into little pieces that I could pick and choose to use what I wanted. The next person that's going to give a perspective is Mark Milliron. Mark has a kind of a checkered background, I guess. He is currently a chaired professor at the University of Texas at Austin. And he's also the executive director of the National Institute for Staff and Organizational Development, which is looking for ways to fundamentally change the staff that are inside educational organizations. But prior to that, he worked for a long time with Oracle and with SAS in the private sector side. So he brings both a very unique academic but tempered by business reality type of perspective to this.
I want to get a little bit closer to you so I can talk about this in more depth. We did a group of student focus groups probably about a year and a half ago and got some really interesting kind of ideas from them. Before I jump into the results of that, I want to ask you real quickly, how many of you work or have worked in the world of education? Okay. Look at the numbers, folks. I don't need to ask how many of you have been students. You've all been there. When we now go to students and ask them about their experience in the world of education, what's really interesting about is that what they tell us they like and what they tell us they don't like. What's really fascinating is, you know what the number one thing they didn't like was? They talked a lot about, and Ellen, your PowerPoint was wonderful. I loved your PowerPoint, so don't take this in for wrong. One of the things they told us is that the unbelievable overuse of PowerPoint, right? They called it death by PowerPoint.
That's why I had three.
Right, you had three.
Two of them were cartoons.
And one of them said in the focus group, most people who use PowerPoint have no power nor a point. And what they're talking about when they're going in depth is whether or not we're actually taking all these resources that George and Ellen and Michael are talking about, whether or not we're actually thinking about how we maestro them together to really touch learners in the way they need to be touched today. I have a very fundamental argument. My fundamental argument is that the economic and social underpinnings of our world have drastically changed. Our education system has not yet caught up and or transformed in the right way to get onto it. But technology, along with a lot of goodwill and hard work, can help us get there. That's the basic argument. Let's kind of begin with our economic and social infrastructure. You've heard it 1,000 times. We've moved from the agrarian revolution to the industrial revolution. Now we're in the information knowledge revolution. You don't need to tell any of us that kind of world. The challenge as we've made that transition is a lot of our underpinning parts of our society have begun to shift, including our economies, but education hasn't gotten there quite yet. In fact, most people, when you look at education, what do? In education? We operate an industrial factory model on an agrarian calendar, mm-hmm. trying to meet the needs of the information age. So we're doing, I mean, how many of you harvest in the summer? But we're still taking summers off, aren't we? That's an agrarian model that was based out of that whole piece. Now Richard Florida wrote a wonderful book a few years back, National Book Club Award winner, called The Rise of the Creative Class. His newest book's called The Flight of the Creative Class. And really makes the point that in a flat world, in a connected world, what happens is that we're not flat, we're spiky. What he means by that is some communities really get it and they take off because of the use of education. Others fall through the floor because of the creative infrastructures that they're really investing into. And so some people are really investing in education and getting their return on investment. Others really aren't. But he makes the case, and I really buy this, that we are about to see a fundamental overhaul of the architecture of education, just like we did when we moved from the agrarian to the industrial age. Think about it. At the agrarian age time, we had one-room schoolhouses and we had big universities. And we only needed a small number of people with any kind of university degrees, and we needed a small basic amount of information to allow people to run farms. The majority of our economy was on farms. We then, as the Industrial Revolution came in, we invented high schools. That only happened in the early 20th century. We invented community colleges. We invented land-grant universities to expand education so more people could have that so they could participate in the industrial economy. Well, now as we move from the industrial to this new age, we have to reinvent education again and think very differently about how we're going to be able to connect with people. Because 30 years ago, folks, only 20% of a graduating high school class ever went on to get some kind of post-baccalaureate, any kind of baccalaureate experience. Now you're seeing 65 to 85% of a graduating high school class going on into post-secondary education. The challenge is we never invented our high schools for that. Our high schools, I don't know how many of you, but in my high school, there was a small group that was in the accelerated class that was intended to go to higher education. Today, we fully expect all of our high school students to be college ready. But if you look at the college placement test and you look at where how many people are actually college ready when they hit the door, fully 50 to 70% of the people who test into college need some kind of remedial developmental education work because we haven't got our system set up for that. Are you with me? So what we're doing is we're trying to think about how we use these technologies to fundamentally overhaul this architecture and think differently about how we touch and re-engage our students. How can we use online, in-class, hybrid, and everything else externally to be able to get these folks? And what's happened is you all have end-run the world of education. You all are going out and getting your own certifications, getting your own information, and especially boys. If you look at higher education, boys in particular are beginning to just drop out completely. The average community college in this country has a 60-40 mix, 60% female, 40% male. Okay? And if you look at medical schools, law schools, predominantly female, because boys are dropping out and going getting education and certification in other kinds of places. So for us, the idea is how do you kind of think about how does education fit in this new world and how do we re-architect it? And I'm going to argue our current education system, time-bound, it's all about the time when you go to learn. Place-bound, you have to go to school to learn. Okay, we're bureaucracy-bound, you got to follow the rules, you got to follow the infrastructure, and it's role-bound, teacher there, student here. And those things have to be blown up for us to be able to kind of reinvent the world of education. Something that can help. The technology, we've talked a lot about Web 2.0 technologies, learning objects, learning online, all these different kinds of tech tools and techniques using. I'm a big fan of using gaming in education. The problem with using the word games in education is some faculty members say, how dare you talk about games in education? Learning is serious business. It's hard work. You have to, don't call it games. In fact, one of the best theorists on this is a guy named Chris Deedy, who's at Harvard University, studies games in the world of education. And for the longest time, he called it gaming in education, but people got mad at him about this. Learning is hard work. Don't you dare call it fun. And so he tried something. He changed the name for one of his articles, and he called it Multi-User Virtual Environmental Experiential Simulators.
Yeah.
Which the acronym is MOVIES, by the way. And suddenly he got all kinds of acclaim, and people got really excited, and they wanted to be a part of the entire thing. Mm-hmm. And he came back about 6 months later, and he's like, you realize what I did, folks? Same stuff. I just changed the names. You guys couldn't handle the fact that you had to work hard, and your education was painful, so you think their education has to be hard and has to be painful. And we have to get over that. Something that's going to help us is how do we think about how we use games, how we use social networking, how we use online learning tools, all the other things at our disposal. I'm going to argue one thing that we need to think about is how do we leverage analytics? How do we leverage all the data and information we have about what works and what doesn't work? And I'll just give you some simple examples. How many of you shop at Amazon.com? What happens at Amazon after you buy a book? People like you who bought this book also bought this, this, and this, right? In fact, you can't even finish checking out before they start doing that to you, right? All of that is based on a huge predictive analytics array where they look at all people like you, all the things they've bought in the past, and what they might buy in the future, and they make a guess in the moment about what you might like. Are they pretty good about it? Yeah, you know, when they first start working with you, they're not that good. They get better and better. But the more they know you, they start sending recommendations to you, and you're like, how in the world do you know I like this stuff? And sure enough, they get to know you a lot better. In fact, iTunes does this now, right? You have a just for you section, all based on predictive analytics, customization based on you. I would argue the local Pizza Hut knows more about a student's proclivities than the local school does. Because of customer relationship management and analytics. They're able to kind of dive in and get those kinds of data. Give you a simple example. My wife got a call from a credit card company last year. Have you lost your credit card? No, I don't think so. Can you check? And so she went and checked, and sure enough, her credit card's gone. How did you know? And being the nice Southern girl she is, she ended up in a 45-minute conversation with a nice man in India. She found out the whole story. She found she did. And she befriended the guy, and she found out the whole thing. About 2 hours earlier, she had lost her card at a local coffee shop, we found out later. The person then proceeded to go to a gas station that was within 5 miles of our house. But it was a gas station she doesn't normally go to. Boom, they start watching the credit card, just by trigger analytics, risk analytics. Then, this is the part that freaks me out, they bought an amount of gas she doesn't normally buy. She owns a Suburban. It takes $600 to fill up her car. They bought something less than that. Second trigger goes off, which says, call her, make sure it's her using the card. Yep. They called her, it wasn't, and they turned it off. Yep. How many of you have gotten one of those calls? In fact, sometimes now you have to call ahead if you're going to travel, right, and tell them you're going to go somewhere so they don't cut your card off when you're doing this. Think about that example for a second. A bank with millions of customers worldwide, literally millions of customers worldwide, one of them loses their card, and with 2 hours, based on behavioral analytics, they're able to notice it's not them using the card, have somebody in India call somebody in North Carolina, and they turn off the card. Do you think our expectations are going to start going up? I'm going to argue that students of tomorrow are going to ask this very simple question. Can you use information about me? And the truth is, we use information about students all the time. But by the time schools pull it together, analyze it, meet together, figure out what to do about it, and change something, what's happened to that student?
Graduated.
They've graduated. Yep. They've gone. They've dropped out. What students want to know is, can you use information about me to help me today? Pick a better class, choose a better learning object, go in a better direction, make a better choice. Are you with me? It's a totally different way of thinking about this. What you're going to be seeing on the road ahead because of analytics and the use of different kinds of engaging technologies, you're going to be seeing education do things like a month before you go to the university, you'll get a link to a massive multiplayer online game that's actually an orientation that teaches you about your institution for a while. Okay, you're going to start seeing learning objects that are actually modular games that teach you about really difficult concepts. Because you're engaged in the learning process, you'll learn how to do it. And guess what? You'll rank them, and you'll tell us which ones are the best ones and which ones are not very useful. We'll have clear outcomes that will tell us which are the ones that actually lead to competencies and certifications and degrees. And you'll share that information with each other and with the faculty, who will know that these learning objects actually help students more than other learning objects. And that'll be driven. I mean, think about that. Students like you have had a this problem with algebra, have found this learning object useful. How great would that be? Okay, when you're sitting at home wondering what the hell to do with that class. Okay, and what's going to happen is this kind of just-in-time, analytics-driven, based information combined with all the engaging technologies we're talking about are going to allow us to begin to transform the world of education, because we're able to ask hard questions. Because all you have to do is, again, read, you know, Thomas Friedman, The World is Flat, read Richard Florida, read about the economic exigencies that are going on out there. You realize our education system is really going to be pushed to fundamentally shift because we're desperately behind. I mean, you hear the data about engineers all the time. How many engineers did China turn out last year? Something like 600,000. How many did India turn out? About 300,000. You know how many we turned out? 65 is the last one I heard. 65,000, and half of those were foreign-born. Mm-hmm. So we're in a time when we really need to think about our science, technology, engineering, and math, and complete overhaul of our architecture. But I would argue that we need to think about what works, and it's not the factory model. The factory model has served us well for a long time, but we need to think about how can we become more customized, more individualized, and we can pull it all together. We might be suffering from actually affection deficit disorder, because the part of our education system that really works is K through 5, where we get really personal and we get connected with people and we really know them and we nurture them. When they go into the factory, we begin to get Darwinian and we tear people away. So the question for me is how we can do things in a different way. So, last point, just to actually kind of drive this home, I want you to play with me for a second. You've been sitting for a while. I need you to stand up.
All of us?
You can join in too.
Oh, let's do it.
Now, don't do anything until I say go. I'm going to give you a set of directions. Please don't do anything until I say go. I'm going to explain the whole thing, then we're going to start. First thing you're going to do is you're going to turn to somebody on your right or your left, and you're going to give them the biggest hug you've ever given anybody in your entire life. Stop. Not till I say go. Hold yourself back. Calm down up here. Okay. So, and then after we do the giant hug, you're going to turn to somebody on the other side, and you're going to do what's called a New Zealand tribal greeting. And in the New Zealand tribal greeting, you reach and grab their cheeks. I'm talking about their face, by the way. You then press your forehead against their forehead, and you share the breath of life. Oh. Are you guys okay? Some of you are like, you're at a tech conference, man.
Do this.
Okay, I'm kidding. Sit down. Everybody breathe. You're okay. Come on, let it out. You're good. You should have seen your faces. It was great. The minute I said the hug thing, you refused to look left or right. It was like directly ahead. And, whenever I do that exercise, it's amazing to me, first, that there's a whole group of people who are the huggers. And you know who you are. And they're like, oh, great, I get to hug somebody. When they're on it. Case in point.
Mark, we're from California.
They're from California. That explains it. OK. Okay. And there's a whole other group of people who have their therapist on speed dial, right? I was almost touched at a tech conference. It's wrong. I need an appointment right away. I did this once at a distance learning conference with about 2,000 people, and I said, in a second, you're going to turn to somebody in your right or your left and give them the biggest hug you've ever given anybody. And a woman went, poof, passed out. I'm not kidding. I'd take her outside and put water on her face. I felt horrible for her. I felt worse for the guy next to her. And then we did this again once in D.C., and everybody sat back down, and the guy in the front row turns to the person beside him and said, I was really looking forward to hugging you. Why I bring that up is this exercise alone shows the principle of heterogeneity, of how different we all are. We all know when you drive up to the family reunion, church, whatever it is, you see the huggers out front, right? Who want to hug every human being who comes in. Then other people drive up and see the huggers, and what do? They drive around back, find another way, become an atheist, whatever it is. They're not going to deal with the huggers, right? Okay. We're all so different. And there are some people who are going to love everything online. There are some people who are going to want everything face-to-face. Most people, by the way, are going to want something in the middle because that's what we do right now. We hybrid almost everything. We drive doctors crazy. We go to WebMD and self-diagnose and come in with the printouts, right? We're hybriding everything. The question is, can we thoughtfully use our insights, our social networks, our relationships, and our analytics to help make better choices? I'm going to argue the overhaul of education will involve all of that. And I was thinking about not the one best way. Here's the problem. In education, you have really, really sharp people looking at it. They keep looking for the one best way to teach and reach our students. And what's worse is we do things like the Spelling Commission, or we do things like No Child Left Behind, which is really, let's work harder at a system that really isn't working. That's really what it's actually saying. Let's take a look at what we can do to fundamentally overhaul the architecture and think differently about using these technologies to really engage students. So I'm going to turn it back to Michael.
Thanks very much. We're going to open it up for questions now, but just as a kind of final wrap-up, I wanted to say, you know, what Mark was just going, that was kind of fun, you know, stand up and laugh and stuff. That's what we need. That's what we need in education, is fun. You know, then there's this whole movement in the game area to, you know, bring educational games online and develop these. And they even call it the serious games movement. And I really hate that because games are supposed to be fun. That's what the basis is. We've got to figure out how to put the fun back in learning, fun back in education, apply a lot of what we've learned in games and in social networks to that, and then we can, you know, maybe see some fundamental change going out there and see some hope for the future in terms of people getting engaged again in their learning. Okay. So if they're, yes, go ahead, Ellen.
I want to jump in on something that when Mark mentioned it. Is Paul McKee in the room? Is he here? There is a wonderful guy here at this conference named Paul McKee. Paul we were talking about some of these issues just last week, and Paul observed that when you talk about profiling students, and it's really talking back to the analytics, that something that many of us forget is that every single cow that is sold, every single bit of cattle has a little tag in its ear. And, you know, you can look at that little, he called them bovine objects. He was talking about bovine objects to me.
I call them cow chips.
Cow chips, that's right. So he pointed out that the thing that most of us forget is that you can look at those tags, and it will tell you every single thing about that single steak on a hoof that you want to know about. We cannot get anywhere near like that with our learners at all. The fact that there has no way for us to start looking at analytics. And I'm not suggesting that we all tag ourselves, but I will tell you that some really interesting research around the use of RFID tags with individual learning preferences keyed to learning assets in an environment to be able to not, in fact, ask you, do you want to have that thing? And it's beyond Amazon, beyond TiVo. It won't even ask you. It's just going to know because of the way that you've interacted. So that idea of ubiquity with your computing assets really is not science fiction. It really is something happening right now. I do think that we've got to get smarter about not just always looking at that future of where the fun stuff's going to be. I mean, I love that part too, don't get me wrong. But I've been dancing around this particular issue for a really long time, and I think that until we all get serious about how we can show our impact and results, not in a boring way that beats the enthusiasm out of us, but to show evidence so that we can do better decision-making, I think we're really missing a good bet.
Any questions? Yes. or I can repeat it, either one.
Experiences. I know my biggest problem is research versus education. So how do we make these models work in research-driven institutions? How do we make that, build that bridge?
That's what our one guy.
Michael knows I feel pretty strongly about this. I really think if we want transformative teaching and learning to be happening in our research institutions in particular, and remember, in higher education, there's a real there's a whole array of different kinds of institutions. You have the community colleges, the research one institutions, private liberal arts institutions, and everything in between. Some folks are more focused on teaching and learning and others aren't. I would argue that especially in our research institutions where we're touching undergraduates, we have to really attack the promotion and tenure process. You just have to. I mean, it's a sacred cow. You can't really talk about it. But until assistant professors are actually rewarded for quality teaching, you are not going to see a lot of focus. Those folks get tenure. They get their lifetime appointments by doing research and publications. That's how the process works. And people are just funny that way. They do what they're rewarded for. And so until we attack that fundamental system, it's going to be a real challenge. And by the way, in the public schools and in other places, some folks just get rewarded for staying around long enough to be able to get to tenure. We just have to take teaching and learning seriously. Ellen made the point. We have to have, I would argue, in the world of education, we have to develop a culture of inquiry mm-hmm. where we're willing to really ask hard questions and peel back the onion about what really works and what doesn't work in our institutions, what is really showing the outcomes of our processes, and how can we get from point A to point B more effectively using the different tools we have. But you got to look at the fundamental reward systems for us to get mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I love the example from Michigan Virtual University that the largest cohort of students in Michigan Virtual University were students from the University of Michigan dorm. So they were hybriding whether you liked it or not, right? They were taking on-class courses and online.
As I told you earlier, we built a community of educators to work together to build new content. And our first meetings, we had high schools, virtual high schools, folks from big departments of education, states all around the country, people from community colleges, and people from R1s. And to our astonishment, the people in community colleges and high schools really were on track. They really had similar needs. They figured out how to work together. And the R1s are kind of over here. And they don't do teaching. They do research. But what happened in the community was that the R1s led the way in sort of innovative ways of putting the content together. And ultimately, there was a bond that was formed between the people that were teaching every day and the people that thought that they were the experts of what the content was. And there was a point, I'll never forget, where we had a meeting about 6 months ago after they'd been working together for a couple of years. And the folks that were teaching every day kind of turned to the R1s and said, "Now, how do you know this works?" And they kind of looked at each other and said, "Well..." And so we're seeing a change now where an awful lot of the work that's being done by those that are actually creating the content, they're bringing it back to the classroom to find out, gee, maybe we ought to find out whether it works before we toss it out there as gospel.
Mm-hmm. How do we keep the use of these analytics from just becoming another Myers-Briggs test, from becoming another maybe more sophisticated, maybe slightly more responsive, but way of basically putting kids into boxes, which is a really, really strong impulse in any sort of large institution.
One of my favorite books on that topic is a book called No Place to Hide, and it really talks about the dangers of the overuse of analytics. I would argue that one of the reasons we should really start looking at a culture of inquiry and the use of analytics in the world of education is that it's all around us anyway. It's being used all the time in all kinds of other sectors. And that if we don't start using it to help more people become educated so they can develop the critical thinking, problem solving, decision making, and life skills to be able to live free, they're going to be manipulated like you can't even imagine. And I would argue that if they don't have those skills, I'm a big believer in Jefferson's quote that democracy without education is a sham, that you need education to make democracy work in particular. So coming back to your point, I think we need sharp people to be able to look at the use of analytics to make sure we're using it in the right way to be able to kind of not only help people learn the the content, but learn how to learn. One of the most important things that they develop is that as they develop their own kind of internal culture of inquiry to develop the examined life. And that's harder to do. And it's not all going to be number crunching. It's going to be the humanistic side. And ironically, the analytics show us again and again that the people connection is probably as or more important than the technology tools. And I think that's one of the, you know, the wonderful kind of beautiful ironies of the entire thing.
But thanks, Mark, you know, there's an interesting sort of twist to that, that what we're talking about in this scenario is the analytics done unto people. When I start looking at the way that we all profile ourselves, whether we're putting our MySpace pages together or whether we're putting our preferences for our TiVo viewing or what have you, every single one of us has a level of comfort with being able to say, I don't want to mess around with that other stuff. This is what I want. And so I think that for all of us, too, flipping the notion of analytics as something being done unto us as opposed to our choosing to have things taken to us in our, on our terms. I mean, this is a shift that I think is really in our hands right now. I use my analytics to make sure that I don't have all that other stuff around me. And sometimes I have to open it up enough to make sure that the stuff I don't think I want can find its way. But this is not, I mean, if we think it's being done unto us, then we've kind of missed the point. We've actually got the power here.
It'd be a shame if we don't use analytics to improve the learning process. I used to run a company called NatG. We did IT training for the Fortune 500. And we had a big learning object repository, and folks would dive in to learn what they needed to learn about whatever application they were working on. And we put in analytics not to really improve the efficiency. People only had a limited amount of time. They wanted to, you know, these are businesses. They wanted to make sure folks got trained as quickly as possible. And so rather than put things in front of them they really didn't need to know, the analytics would sort of cut to the chase and grab from the repository those pieces that really germane to their needs. If we can use them that way, I can see some real value to it. It's just got to be done in an ethical way. Yeah. We have a public website called Hippocampus. It has a big repository of curricular objects for students. At Hippocampus, students come in, they find, they can either search for the subject they're looking for, they can use a textbook and put in the pages, and the repository draws out the objects that are, again, germane to that assignment. But along the way, Hippocampus is collecting analytics. And so as the student sort of winds their way through this stuff, it starts to realize where the holes are, and it starts picking out the pieces that are, again, going to help that student get to the end game more quickly. I can see, again, with the right algorithms in place, that could be pretty useful stuff.
Can you all speak to, the closed-mindedness of some universities when it comes to using different scripting languages, that kind of thing, and maybe how to work within those restrictions and maybe security restrictions when developing online content?
Like only open source versus proprietary, or only something grown at home as opposed to commercially available, that type of?
Yeah, I'm trying to use more open source versus like a platform that could cost up to $10,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but within the university framework, we're really having a hard time getting open-mindedness, getting, you know, PHP MySQL servers to be able to build some of that stuff, and working with the web teams to make that kind of stuff happen.
I think there's been a real challenge in the university sector and the community college sector around the three S's, security, stability, and service. I think they've been slammed. Just like right next door at UT Austin, there was a security breach with the McComb School of Business where they took all the social security numbers, and they were able to do a lot of real damage for those folks. So there's some real high-profile security issues that have driven an overreaction in some cases where people have kind of clamped down and said, this is the only way we're going to do it. The challenge is when do they take the infrastructure to run the institution and they run that into their academic programs and how they teach. And I think what they're having to figure out is how do they create islands of innovation within the university to allow for the kinds of diversity you're actually talking about. But it's a scary time in the world of education because they're being pushed so hard, and their technology infrastructures aren't there yet. They really are trying to just stand up. They have a hard enough time getting video data projectors in their class, much less, you know, kind of developing the kinds of, you know, infrastructure you're trying to put together for a dynamic, you know, portal-based, you know, deeply engaging web infrastructure. I'm a big fan of saying most education institutions have segregated their infrastructure planning. They have facilities over here and they have technology over here. And if they really want to talk about the next generation of learning, they got to put that together, and they should never do a facilities plan without their technology plan right with there. And that'll allow them to think about what are the broader tools they should be using to pull that stuff in.
One of the things I've seen done successfully is to argue for, give us a sandbox to play in. Put any walls around that sandbox that you want. Keep it away from the other applications. You know, keep it away from places where you may have Social Security numbers or personal data, but give us a place to play. The Academy should be, and in some cases is, open to experimentation and to trying new things. But I think Mark makes a very good point. Because of some of the high visibility break-ins at university servers, it's kind of oversensitized the security issue out there. But I think if you talk with the IT folks, particularly around the idea of something that's walled off from everything else, where you at least can start to learn and develop some of your techniques that you want to try out there, they may be a little more receptive, you know, on that side. If you can talk to them about the, I recognize the needs for security, but I need more of an open environment than what you're providing to me right now.
There does tend to be this sort of dark side, though. It also has a lot to do with IT support. Yeah. And, you know, the fact is that most campuses have only got X amount of time and energy to be able to dedicate to keeping track of X number of different types of technologies. And so I think for all of us really looking ahead, this touches our world a lot. I mean, we have certain proprietary tools, obviously. We also do a lot of work making sure that we can extend out into the open source communities. We actually gave away PDF. I don't know if you guys knew that. But we've turned PDF over to International Standards Organization to turn it into an ISO standard, because we realized that there's just a point at which you cannot constrain the community when the community wants to go forward. But the real issue is, it comes back to, you know, Mark, you made, I think you made good points, and then the IT support. So this is a place where all of us can get a little bit smarter, too, and making sure we can come up with better reasons for, you know, getting the sandboxes going.
Hi, I'm glad you mentioned No Child Left Behind, because it feels like, you know, for this kind of revolutionary change to happen in education, there needs to be a real overhaul in how teachers are trained, and education is such a large bureaucratic system, and there would need to be change at the state school board level and local school board level, who's actually dictating kind of what teachers are doing in the classroom. Are you seeing any movement to this or openness to that on a policy level?
I'm definitely seeing movement towards that. And I'm pretty excited about some of the policy initiatives that different states are taking on. Florida, Minnesota, North Carolina, and others are beginning to really look across K-20 and think about how they interconnect. You can't solve the teacher training problem without connecting K-12 to the universities. You can't have this kind of, you know, let's throw them over the wall and see what happens. You've got to actually connect and be able to kind of ask some hard questions. I'm going to tee up George to follow up on the teacher thing, because I think he has some good ideas on this. But I do want to give you an idea of kind of some of the things that are being done. I think the early college high schools that are being done, where high schools are being built on college campuses, I think a lot of states are actually really, and I'm a big believer in this, I think middle schools are an absolute failed experiment in this country and need to be blown up. They were, and I don't mean with kids in them, I mean the buildings need to go up. We invented middle schools out of the 60s and 70s, out of the humanistic education movement, thinking those kids needed more support. And it was an experiment in kind of layering that in. And I think what we've done is, if you look at the data, there are no data that say middle schools work whatsoever. And a lot of states are going back to K-8, or they're developing 6 through 12 schools and seeing some really exciting kind of work out of that. Again, I defy anybody to show me data that middle schools anywhere are working, because they're a failed experiment. They're a real challenge. And people are reinventing high schools, because high schools will be, the Southern Regional Education Board is probably doing the most exciting work on high school reinvention, I think, really kind of looking at how you reinvent high schools for the new economic model that we're developing right now. And the Gates Foundation has tried to do some work in that area. And thankfully, they're pretty honest about the fact that their rigor, relevance, and relationship stuff has been powerful, but they don't have any data that says it works yet. And so they're really trying to get behind it. So with that, I'm going to tee it up to George, who has some ideas Gary, about where we're going. He's right. The Southern Regional Education Board is one of the groups that's working hard toward this. As I told you before, our community has an awful lot of boards of education, various states involved. And so your question, are things changing? Is there policy changes? Yeah, there are some folks making some moves. And some exciting things are happening. SREB is involved in a project to put a learning object repository with curricularly relevant content in each of their 16 states that are represented by this institution. As a repository, not only for teachers to come in and use, but also to add materials back and then to share among all the other states. And so there's new technologies and new thoughts being put into education that look like they're coming to the surface. But all that being said, to really get to the kind of places that Mark has been talking about, Ellen has been talking about, you know, where it's a long ways off. And I think it's probably more likely, if we're being honest about this, that the real big changes are going to make things real better are going to happen over a period of time when those of us, or those of you who grew up with these technologies and who use them every day and whose lives are shaped by it, and your ways of thinking are shaped by it, and the way you learn is shaped by it. When they become teachers and politicians, and now you're going to see some big changes, because ultimately it's going to be changed by big economic models. As the economic paradigm shifts where there's a market need, a market demand for these new things, oh, then you're going to see it change. It's not going to be pushing the rock uphill. It's going to go zoop, and we're going to go, you know, move from VHS to CD real quick. And so it's and how far off is that? Well, you were saying that you felt that there's sort of teachers are turning over in the next few years.
Yeah, I think the challenge right now is a lot of the really innovative teachers are being kind of, their spirits are being crushed the minute they get in the schools right now by the traditional architectures that are in place. And we have, you know, maybe 2 years is what the average teacher is lasting. But I think that's going to shift. And I think as you start seeing, it really will take some retirement waves and a generational transition for that to come in. And I think in both the higher ed space, it might be a little bit longer. I just think you're going to see some changes, as you're saying, when the generation begins to shift and the economic exigencies say this is going to happen or you're going to fall so far behind, you're going to be desperately embarrassed by the results.
If people want it and they are going to willing to pay for it, it'll all happen. But, you know, sort of to dictate it, come on, it's going to take
the bigger challenge is right now is we are trying to get teachers who have never learned with these tools to teach with these tools. Okay? And when we have, as Gary's talking about, is we have people who come through who's learned with these tools, begin to teach with them, it's going to be a lot easier.
Thanks.
We can't wait till all of y'all get, you know, in charge.
Hi. I'm actually one of those educators that is kind of disenchanted by. I'm a history PhD student, and I teach a couple of U.S. history surveys. And I use Wikipedia for my textbook. I use Flickr. I have a class blog. That's how my students turn in assignments, things like that. My question's kind of practical. I spend a lot of time actually teaching students how to use a blog, what a blog is. The U.S. History Survey I teach is from Columbus to 9/11. And a lot of students really don't know what a wiki is or how to use a wiki or how to use a blog. So I spend a lot of time teaching that in addition to trying to teach 400 plus years of history. So if you have any advice on how to manage that or address that in some way.
You mean practically? I'll give you practical. Anybody that's
poorly,
in the class in here that's it's a day-to-day teacher, I advise you. I encourage you to go to hippocampus.org. It's a place where an awful lot of this content has been assembled. Really good investment, real good scholarship, and it's also a place where you can participate in making more of it via these social network models that we've talked about. You'd have a blast. Yeah. It's not only some great stuff to begin with, but you'd be put together with folks that are doing this for a living. And learning innovative ways to use blogs, use wikis, to use all this stuff. That's a starting point.
Yeah. I would also argue that the skills you're teaching them in how to approach social networking tools, blogs, wikis, responsibility, the ethics involved in, you know, posting things out there, the idea that, no, maybe you don't want to disclose everything about yourself in your Facebook or MySpace account. Those are skills that
life skills.
Not necessarily more important than knowing the history, but they are life skills that are critically important for their entry into the workforce out there. So you're teaching them a lot of stuff that they really need to know, even if it isn't mm-hmm. in your formal curricula of this is, you know, what happened, you know, in this year and this year and this year.
Yeah. I mean, the way I approach it is I can't cover everything. So I try to encourage them to go do it.
Yeah.
Half of them do, and half of them, you know, don't care because most people don't like U.S. history anyways. So
it's something we haven't really talked much about. We kept talking about technologies, but I think we all agree that what one learns, how you learn in school needs to change, pick up, but what you learn needs to change too. There's not an awful lot that you walk away from in your high school education you need to apply every day. There's some, of course. But, you know, most of the life skills that really get us through the day, especially new students through the day, they learn outside the classroom. It's, you know, just being immersed in the technologies that really hold the world together, the societies, at least the ones we live in, and the business together is stuff that we, for whatever reason, hasn't got into the curriculum yet. And so you're doing quite a service to your students to bring them in.
Another idea to try, and I've seen other institutions do this, and I don't know your institution, so I can't tell you if this is going to work
George
or not.
Mason.
As I go around the country in higher education in particular, that there are some libraries, LRCs, that are on fire, that really get the new technology and have begun to own it and do a lot of things with it. Others are just kind of retired in place and don't want to change at all. They're really angry almost about all this change. And in fact, I wrote an article called Are You Dying to Use Technology? Where I tracked some of these folks' adoption of technology along Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of death and dying, right? Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. That being said, hopefully your LRC is really doing some good work, because if you can, you can partner with them. And what I've found is a lot of faculty members are able to work with them to actually take some of that burden for teaching IT literacy off their shoulders, and they'll develop some modules and resources where they'll do some of the human interactive side of what Gary's talking about, connect them to those external resources, but then getting somebody on the ground they can talk to as well. Rio Salado College in Arizona actually set up a 1-800 call center that actually helps students learn this stuff, because they found out their content faculty were spending 70% of their time teaching students technology. And so they set up a resource that does nothing but help them learn the technology side of it. I have no idea if they'll set up a call center, but at least The library is a good first place to start.
Actually, no, there's one, just one real quick example that I want to throw in here, which is going to be a bit of a challenge for those of us who've ever had to be in a classroom, which is that there is the ability for students to take responsibility for their own learning. Yeah. And the thing that we've been seeing, schools like Purdue, which have actually taken new technologies, and they literally throw it out into the community to see how long it takes. I mean, these are sort of pilots. How long does it take for people to get up to speed? And there had been all kinds of concern about we have to train these people, do all these types of things, these students, whatever, faculty. But the issue is when you give people a chance to go out and actually try it and set it up, it takes the burden off you. And it allows, giving people the task to figure it out themselves and to discover it all of a sudden makes it more relevant for them, too. So can't get into specifics now because we're out of time, but...
Thanks very much. We appreciate your attendance, and please give a round of applause for the panelists here.